all of the things that people have done over the years really matter. Whether you're talking about government or companies, when they see people taking those steps, when they see the citizen leaders taking the steps, they follow.
Hello, Vicki Robin here, host of What Could Possibly Go Right, a project of Post Carbon Institute. We interview cultural scouts, people who see far and serve the common good, and social artists, people who feel deeply and inspire. We ask each our one question. In the midst of all that seems to be going awry, what could possibly go right? Today's guest is Elisa Gravitz, President and CEO of Green America. Green America develops marketplace solutions to social and environmental problems with a key focus on tackling climate change, building fair trading systems, stopping corporate abuse, and growing the green economy. Elisa is a nationally recognized leader in the social investment and solar industries. She authored Green America's acclaimed Guide to Social Investing and the popular Guide to Community Investing. She co-convened the Solar Circle and co-authored several solar thought leader papers. What I've always loved about Elisa, and I did in this interview as well, is that while she works on policy and investing, she is eternally enthusiastic about what individuals, households, small business owners, and communities of place can do to make bottom-up change, which she points out trickles up. So here's my conversation with Elisa. Welcome, Elisa Gravitz, to What Could Possibly Go Right. You know, we interview cultural scouts like you to help us see what you see emerging. Our focus isn't on what should go right, but what our guests see coming down the pike that lights a path in these times. And so how perfect that we're speaking on Earth Day 2023. We've known one another for nearly 30 years, and you've always been a what could possibly go right person. Green economy, renewable energy transition, conscious consumerism. For decades, you've held the values that are so necessary now as we go through the consequences of not acting soon enough while steering away from the worst outcomes. In particular, since you've been involved for decades in developing solar energy capacity, I'm curious how you see the burst of energy transition activity coming out of the Inflation Reduction Act. You know, it's like it's suddenly everything speeded up. So what developments do you celebrate? What could we do better, like much better? What approaches miss the mark and possibly set us back? You know, what's missing? What's on track? So what do you see emerging in that area that our listeners can take heart from and cooperate with? And in addition, Elisa, since you are such a caring person and have worked on changing individuals and household behaviors, where in the social sphere do you see change for the better? So having seeded the ground, Elisa, please walk us through your perspectives now in 2023. And I'm going to ask you our regular question, what could possibly go right?
Oh, thank you, Vicki. It's so good to be with you here today and on Earth Day and with all these people that you reach and you touch and you inspire. Thank you so much for the honor. And I have to say, I just love your question. I just love the name of this podcast because there is a lot that can go right. And actually, if you look at the heart of things, is going right. We have a long way to go. There's a lot of serious problems right now. I don't want to sugarcoat anything. And at the same time, there's so much to be taking inspiration and encouragement from. And I love that that's where you focus. Mm-hmm. So when it comes to renewable energy, that is 100% the case. I want to thank everyone who's listening here because I know that a lot of people who listen to you, Vicki, are people who, you know, for decades have been doing things like reducing their energy use, thinking about how they could walk and bike instead of taking a car, thinking about how they could take mass transit instead of a car. All of the things that people have done over the years really matter. When you take those individual steps, two really important things happen. The steps in and of themselves are important because they make a difference. And when they add up and other kinds of leadership, whether you're talking about government or companies or religious, when they see people taking those steps, when they see the leaders, the citizen leaders taking the steps, they follow. I'm going to tell you a lot of really great news about what's happening in the renewable energy world. And none of this would be the case. I wouldn't be able to make this report to you if it wasn't for each and every person taking those steps. Mm-hmm. And so if you ever wonder in your own personal life, if you take these steps, does it matter? Absolutely, it matters at those both levels. The thing is important in and of itself, and it gets others to take action. So thank you. So on renewable energy, there is just amazingly good news. Right now, around the world, between 80 and 90% of the new energy that's being put into place for, you know, a growing population and growing needs is renewable energy. Wind and solar are the least expensive energy sources in the world right now, and their prices continue to go down. So even people who are not saying, oh, we must do this for the climate, for the environment, for social equity, for people's health, because obviously renewable energy like wind and solar isn't putting pollutants into the air. Even if you don't have all those perspectives, the fact that all of us have insisted on this all these years because the economics are so good, it's moving forward. Let me give you an example of how powerful it is. The International Energy Agency, which is a big policy organization associated with the United Nations that gives countries advice on what to do about their energy policy. For years and years and years, they've been a thorn in our side because they've been saying, oh no, you must do all of the above. You must, you know, expand your coal and your oil and your gas because you'll need it. A year ago, July, they did a complete 180. And they said, because the prices of renewable energies have come down, we are now recommending that every country stop creating new fossil fuel facilities and they go renewable. I mean, this is global. This is huge. Countries all over the world are not only here, but all over the world have really accelerated their renewable energy production. You know, that's important in industrial countries. It's equally important in emerging economies because renewable energy means you have to walk less far to get your water. It means you can have a small refrigerator for your medicines. It means that you don't have to burn kerosene in your lanterns to have light at night so kids can do their schoolwork. Again, that's a health measure because breathing in kerosene fumes is not good for you either. It's just phenomenal what this does. And it's really exciting. There's even good news for a bad reason or sad reason is that some energy experts have said that the war in Ukraine has accelerated by probably 10 years the implementation of renewable energy around the world. Even without that, we were on track. I mean, not only the climate team at my organization, we here at Green America, we have an amazing climate team. You know, our goal 20, 30 years ago was by 2050, we would have a fossil-free energy economy with half of that coming from renewables. So we think we're now at 2040, and this was before the disruptions from the Ukrainian war. And it wasn't just us. I mean, you could say, well, these advocates, well, that's what they would think. But it wasn't just us. The elite technology forecasting team at Google says the same thing, that maybe by 2042 we could be there. There's a energy forecasting group at MIT who says the same thing. So I know there's a lot of climate despair out there, but when it comes to renewable energy, things are looking really exciting. And then, of course, the thing that's right next to that is the electric vehicles. Almost every major country around the world has pretty ambitious electric vehicle targets, including our country. For example, places like in Scandinavia, they're headed to 30 or 40% electric vehicles. They're closing down gas stations. I mean, even places like China and India, also very, very similar. I mean, it's really, really exciting. I know a number of us are worried about things like lithium and batteries and so on and so forth, but there's some really great new technological developments. I think we're at that early stage, so there's a transition in materials, but I think, you know, within 5 to 10 years, we're going to have much better materials that we're going to be able to use. We're going to be able to recycle all of that. So again, it's going to take a lot of people doing a lot of hard work, everything from saying, if I'm going to buy a vehicle, it's going to be electric, all the way up to including all the engineers working on the new kinds of batteries and on the recycling. Lots of work to do, don't get me wrong, but it's looking really good. And the electric vehicles are really great for the grid because they help balance the grid so we can put more and more renewable energy on the grid. You know, if you charge up in the middle of night, we can literally roll the electricity that's generated at night, maybe by wind energy, and we don't need so much of it. We can capture it in our electric vehicles and we can use it during the day. So there's just really great things that are happening there. Again, it's because of all the steps that everyone here in this audience has taken, and we have a lot more steps, but it's looking really promising. And another area that my organization, I think the folks here at Green America are so excited about, is the other side of the equation, the agriculture side. That's something in terms of what's going right. I am so excited about the possibilities for, some people call it regenerative agriculture, some people call it farming with Mother Nature, some people call it carbon farming, some people call it focusing on soil health. But whatever you call it, it is so exciting and so great because it's a climate solution that addresses what I call all four parts of the climate requirements. Number one, agriculture uses a lot of energy. And if you take a more regenerative approach, you're greatly reducing the energy use in agriculture. So you're greatly reducing your emissions. You're reducing your emissions of some of the worst things like nitrous oxides, that when you make fertilizers, you get these nitrous oxide gases that are worse than carbon dioxide by many factors. When you take all those inputs out of the supply chain, you get all kinds of benefits, one of them being reduction in emissions. And of course, you get health benefits for farmers and people who eat, who I guess are mostly all of us, you know, so it's amazing. So you get the first strategy of climate, which is emissions reductions, you get by moving in this direction. A second thing you get is what drawdown, right? So even if tomorrow afternoon we had a fossil-free world, there's already a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere that's going to cause havoc if we don't bring it back down. Well, if you bring it back down through agriculture, you can do it globally while you're doing something that we all need, producing food, and you get extraordinary benefits by using soil health, regenerative soil health practices. You draw down that carbon. I mean, I remember I was so excited when I got involved in this, like, oh, seventh grade science, right? Plants breathe in carbon dioxide and release oxygen. Yay, that's great. So they're breathing in that carbon dioxide. Well, what are they doing with it? They're making sugars and carbohydrates that not only feed us, well, you know, when we eat our veggies, that's where that came from. Those plants got the carbon dioxide, the carbon to make that food for us out of the atmosphere, but they also use it in the soil, and that's what draws it down. They provide the sugars to the microorganisms in the soil that then their little carbon beings, they take it deep, deep, deep into the soil, and they're short-lived carbon beings, so they bring it down and then they cycle of life and all, they pass on, and the next generation of little microorganisms brings that soil down, that carbon down. So we're getting a lot of carbon drawdown. Dr. Ratan Lal, who is a very famous soil scientist, and he says that with just a 1% increase in carbon in the soil from around the world, we could bring all of the carbon dioxide up that's in the atmosphere back down to the ground and back down to before industrial level of carbon in the atmosphere. I mean, it's so exciting because we would be doing it in a way that's environmentally and socially beneficial in every way. And I'll get back to that in a minute. So we've got the fossil fuel emissions that comes from regenerative agriculture. We've got the carbon drawdown. We also get, if we only pay attention, we get food access, food security. So from a social justice perspective, this is really important. There's a lot of people who both are working on the regenerative agriculture and also the land back work, which returns the land to indigenous peoples. And for example, in our country, agriculture has been a very racist world, the policies, but this is a really great way to do land back and reparations. So there's an extraordinary social justice component for it. And there's also a social justice component in it from the very fact that it improves food access and food accessibility. So that's really important. So you have this really important equity perspective, a part of regenerative agriculture. And then the last thing is, the last part of climate that's so important is the climate resiliency. The making the soil healthier makes the impacts that we already know we're going to have, unfortunately, more flooding in agricultural areas, more drought in agricultural areas, it's going to make our agriculture more resilient so that, you know, if we want to eat in 20 years, we'll be able to. So it's so inspiring. I like to spend August at Green America. We have a big program called the Soil Carbon Initiative, and we work with farmers all over the world. And in August, I get to go and visit farms. It's my favorite thing in the world to do. And this August, I focused on the high plains in our country, so the Dakotas and Montana, Wyoming, and then down into Nebraska. And as one of the farmers said to me, they said, Alisa, you know what's going on out there? We have a Category 4 drought. And you may have had just terrible. In North Dakota, they got maybe 6 inches of moisture last year. I live in the Washington, D.C. area. We get 50 or 60 inches. Montana got 4 inches. I mean, can you imagine? Right. But the regenerative, the farmers that have been taking care of their soil and the regenerative farmers, I visited one of the farmers in North Dakota. His fields were so beautiful. Mm-hmm. I was there. It was a cool day in August in North Dakota. It was only 88 degrees. So we were lucky, but it was still hot. And we're walking through the fields, and there's so much moisture held by the soil and held by these healthy plants that when I got to the other side of the field, from my knees down, my jeans and my boots were damp. Across the little dirt road on the neighbor's field, I mean, these lush fields. Oh, by the way, I should just try to paint the picture. These fields are lush. They're beautiful. He's got, you know, 19 different species growing, plant species growing on that land. You've got the bees. You've got the butterflies. I mean, it's beautiful. The soil is springy. You walk across that little dirt road to the neighbor that's not yet doing this. That neighbor didn't have crops that year. The drought was so bad. The soil temperature was 122 degrees.
Wow.
And it looked parched. You know, you've seen those, you know, when you see that parched soil, you've seen photos of that. You know, and this is just across a dirt road. At 120 degree soil temperature, nothing grows. Those little soil microorganisms die out. They're the little soil microorganisms is what is kind of provides all of life for the soil and the plants and everything we eat. Across the road back at my farmer friend, soil temperature was 77.
Wow.
That's a nice temperature. So it's just like that resiliency. This is what we need. You know, this is also it's resiliency and equity and global food security and food access. So one of the great things that's going right out there is we have the regenerative agriculture solution that reduces emissions, draw down carbon, provides equity, and provides resiliency. And it is moving really fast. The word is out in farm country. Oh, you know, you look across the dirt road at your neighbors who have crops and you don't, and you say, what am I going to learn here? There's so much great news there. And like Dr. Lal says, you know, just all we have to do is increase the carbon in the soil by 1%. And that's that's easy to do. Being thoughtful and intentional, you don't have to go to the ultra marathon graduate school level to be able to do that. You can take those steps. If you have land, you can take those steps.
Right.
So those are some of the things that show to me that there's a lot that's going right, that there's a side of humans that where they can work together, they can get together and they can create amazing things.
Yeah. So I'm curious about the incentives. You know, I mean, 10 years ago, people weren't necessarily doing this. What do you think are the incentives that are getting people to participate, whether it's farmers or whether it's consumers or companies forming that innovate in some field that is regenerative or renewable? Is it the financial incentives? Is it the Inflation Reduction Act? Is there money? Where's money coming into this? How is self-interest? Because we know that self-interest really drives things. Mm-hmm. How is self-interest coming in and accelerating this transformation?
So like so much of the in the world that you walk, Vicki, and the great people that you talk with on this podcast, so much of it is about the pathfinders, like you, Vicki. I mean, just like, you know, your many decades work on helping people understand the choices they make every day. So it starts with the pathfinders. And that usually has nothing to do with economics. That has to do with people really tuning into, things can't keep going this way. We need to tune into what could go right. And they're often the ones that are the innovators, And then you need those you know, early adopters or those fast followers who look over those fences and say, huh, something very interesting going on here. Oh, we need more of this. And so there's many pathways to get to where things take off. But I think you have to start with those pathfinders and those innovators and those early adopters, like so many people listening today, because we can have this conversation and I can tell you all these exciting things that's happening in my world of renewable and regeneration. It's because people took all these steps. So part of it is that leadership that comes and sometimes takes decades. But as we all get together and innovate, as we all get together and find the ways of doing things, as we do all of those things and the costs, like you say, come down, then more and more and more people join in, for sure. And there's all of those additional benefits so that come. So, like, you know, staying with the regenerative agriculture story, you know, some of the farmers that we've had the joy of working with for over a decade, many of them actually did get started for exactly the reason you are talking about. They saw that they couldn't keep doing the things that they were doing, that things were going to get that even though that with conventional farming, even though their yields were going up, like maybe if they had doubled over 20 years, their cost had quadrupled or quintupled. Mm-hmm. And they went, wait a second, there's going to come a point in time when even though my yields went up, it's the costs are going to be more. And it's already hard enough to be a farmer. And the margins are already often not there if we have too much rain or too little rain. Oh my gosh, or something. Anyway, so a lot of them that could kind of see into that 3 to 5 years started to say, what do I need to do? What do I need to do? And then they discovered, they would literally go online and they would say, oh, look, even though I'm in Georgia, and even though I grow corn and rice and cotton, this guy over there in Ohio is growing pumpkins. And look at that. Oh my gosh, I could do those things for my soil. And then you get all those benefits, right? Like again, in the regenerative agriculture, I mean, you save money. On average, our farmers that we work with within 3 years, so this is without any additional external incentives, right? Within 3 years, they're saving, within 3 to 5 years, they're saving half their farm budget. So if you have a 10,000 acre farm and your farm budget is $4 million a year, rough averages, that means you're saving $2 million a year by really focusing on soil health, reducing your emissions, reducing all the fertilizers you're buying, you spend less time on the tractors, you're doing things like, you're not tilling and stuff like that, so you're saving time on the tractor, all kind of great things that are happening. And then you really get into it, right? You see your soil responding, you see the birds and the butterflies and the bees coming back, you see that your land can absorb more water, so that in the spring, if you get too much rain, you don't get flooded. But then when it comes to August and you have too little rain, all that water that's held in your soil, your crops are still taking advantage of. So you get all those benefits and you find out that, oh, your food is more nutritious. So you're the people who buy your food are healthier. So you get these virtuous cycles, and there's not just one, but it's many that come together. When you finally get a lot of folks saying, this is something that's happening right, we need to do more of it, then you get things like the Inflation Reduction Act that are going to, for example, on the renewable energy side, they're going to provide the ability for more people to be able to put in geothermal systems or heat pumps. Mm. It's going to be able to provide for more people who want to get electric vehicles, they'll get a discount. It's going to provide cities and towns to be able to put in charging stations. This now takes us to the next level from all that tapestry that had gotten woven together. And okay, how can we do more right? And it's mm-hmm. the same on the agriculture side. You know, both the Inflation Reduction Act actually provides a lot of funding for some of these things, some of these transition in farm country. It provides cities and towns ways to help their farmers. It provides ways for example, to have more local. One of the things that we've lost in our agriculture system is that everything has gotten very concentrated. So we no longer have, you know, local facilities that, you know, maybe process some food, or if for folks who eat meat, who might be able to get, you know, a locally produced chicken. A lot of that's gone away. So some of the funding provides the restoration of this more local based economy, which of course creates more jobs, creates more community strength. So it's just really exciting. And so it's really great news that all the things that had been done, you know, all the things that people have done, all the innovations that, that people have created are now at the level that we can, are at the scale where we're now leveling up. Again, I don't want to sugarcoat anything because we got, you know, tough times ahead and we have some folks in Congress that would like to draw back those funds and undo some of that. So we do want to, you know, if you get called to action, if you're part of a group that says, hey, let's protect this, jump right in and, you know, tell your representatives that, nope, you know, our communities, the health and well-being and the economic viability of our communities depend on this. Don't you touch that money.
Right.
So those are some of the things. But yeah, everything that each one of us, I mean, we've kind of covered, you asked, you know, what we can each do. We've covered a lot of it, you know, on the energy side. I think everybody here probably knows, you know, the energy efficiency, the electric vehicles. On the agriculture side, I mean, you can literally change the world with your fork by looking for the food that's been grown regeneratively, by asking for it, by supporting your farmers markets. These things really add up to what's going right and what we want more of and what will make a huge difference for the future.
I see that where I am. Another fascination of mine was local food, you know, just basically increasing food resiliency on, because I live on an island, you know, and the pandemic showed us about supply chains, you know, that they can be fragile. And it's not through my efforts at all, but I just recently reviewed what was going on in our food system and the number of farms and the number of CSAs and the number of farm stands. I mean, you can shop every day for local food just by having this little farm stand map. And so it is, it's happening. It's increasing over time. And I hear your message being that individual choices matter, even though it's very compelling to look at, you know, where the technology is going right or wrong, where the funding is going right or wrong. It's very compelling to put yourself in the backseat of the car, or maybe in the trunk, you know, of the electric car, you know, and just say that somebody else is driving this thing. And so
right.
Just to reinforce that, I'm curious, one other thing that I'm curious that you said is, how in the heck is the war in Ukraine going to be a positive for the energy transition?
So there's nothing positive about the war in Ukraine, full stop. The world
right.
would be much better without it, full stop. However, it has driven a lot, because of the disruption of the oil and gas from both Ukraine and Russia, it's been a wake-up call for many countries to put their renewable energy policies onto supercharge. So a lot of the things that were plans are now going into action much, much, much more quickly. And here too, even. So that's of a horrible tragedy that we all wish never happened. It is a little tiny bit of a silver lining of people
right.
are speeding up the plans that were already in place. But when it comes to climate and climate health and equity, to not have a polluting, you know, not having to live next to a polluting plant or facility, when it comes to all of those things, the sooner the better. So that's
right.
The
right, yeah. Right. And so that's a forcing element, you know, just to force people to take the steps.
Exactly. And yeah. Like you were just saying about the food, the number of people that have, you know, whether it's planting their own garden, which, by the way, it's fabulous. And, you know, the community gardens and the CSAs have all been on a big uptick, which is just tremendous. My organization has a Climate Victory Garden program. And so if you have a garden, and you want to look at how you can maximize your garden for taking care of the climate, you can come learn, and then you can register your garden. So you can literally see on the map how all over the country, you know, these gardens are springing up everywhere. It's just Climate Victory Gardens. People can find them. Just Google Climate Victory Gardens and it'll pop up. And it's just so exciting and a good thing. Because if we get any kind of supply disruption, whether it's from human, whether it's from a pandemic or from a war or from even some of the climate disruptions that may happen in the future, you know, growing some of your own food is a good thing. Encouraging your neighbors to grow some of your own food is a good thing. We work with some African-American communities and farmers in the Southeast who are working in their communities to get everybody to do gardens in their front yards so that, and then it's kind of like it's kind of like a whole community effort, and people can help each other grow the food, and from there they're actually starting to do some light processing, so there's like, you know, again, more jobs coming in. So there's just so many ways that this creates community resiliency that is really, really important. And it's joyful. So many people love gardening. So many people love being outside. It's a great way to have everything about it be joyful.
Right. Yeah. Now that's my, you know, the territory of what I used to call, what I called in my book, relational eating. You know, that it basically, by growing a garden or for eating from your, you know, your food shed, you basically come into relationship with the plants and animals that are experiencing the same sun, the same grass. They're experiencing the same environment. Mm. You know, you become part of.
Love that.
You become, so there's, it also feeds that sense of belonging. We have a farm school here, an organic farm school, and they started at Friday night potlucks, and you bring food, and they make little pizzas. And so it's just the community comes together with the toddlers and stuff like that. It's community building as well. Yeah. And I have a huge garden, and I want to look up, and I want to be a climate victory garden person.
I want mine to be registered.
Yeah. I had a huge garden.
Yeah. And so many people are doing so many cool seeds, so many cool things. Just like you said, this building of relation and community. Some of our community, our climate victory gardeners have told us that they've started to do local, what they're calling crop swaps, CROP, crop swaps. And so when you have abundant garden, they kind of like, it's kind of like just a small farmer's market where people come and they bring their abundance, and anyone can come and help themselves for free. And they swap seeds and seedlings and all kind of things that, you know, again, support the community, help people learn how to do things. You know, people say, wow, I never knew that you could grow. You know, maybe they're seeing something that they didn't know could grow in the local area. Oh, yeah, this is how I grow it. You know, oh, yeah. And they said, wait a second. You know, I was at your house 5 or 6 years ago. You have a hill. How are you growing all this food? Oh, I learned how to put in terraces. And then they can help, you know. So, you know, there's all kinds of things that
right.
these gatherings around food and gardening just enhance our communities.
Yeah, there's something about food, too, that it's not political, per se. You know, local food is like everybody gardens. Everybody who gardens, you know, we have an online community of backyard farmers, you know, and we're swapping with each other, and we're swapping information. And there's no political valence on that. You know, it's I find that the domain of food is very empowering. So what I'm hearing you say, Elisa. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. And it's happening in the farm communities as well. One of my favorite stories, and this is from a while back ago, but we, in working with the farming communities, you know, we put, it's kind of like you're saying, farming and soil health and making lives better is something where we can put aside the politics. But when you make the relationships, it also repairs and re-knits the ability to repair some of the relationships. And one of my favorite stories, but it's happened many times, but this is the first time it happened. And so I remember it in great detail. I get a call, you know, like at 6 a.m. from a farmer, because that's when they call. And he says, Elisa, I have something to tell you. And, you know, usually when somebody says that, you think you're about to get some bad news.
Right.
And I said, well, yeah. He says, yeah. I thought, well, you know, you called me. I bet you do have something to tell me. He says, yeah. He says, I want to let you know, we all got together last night. He means the farmers. And he said, we took a vote. And I thought, oh no, I hope they didn't decide they don't want to work with us or something. And he says, now, I don't want you to get me wrong, because we really like working with you. And I thought, he's really preparing me for bad news here. And I didn't know, you know, and he says, you know, we really like working with your team. And, you know, your team is really, they're knowledgeable and they're respectful of farmers. And, you know, we've learned a lot from you and we really like it. And, you know, and then together we had helped them put together a small processing facility. It was actually a soybean roasting. So they didn't have to send their soybeans away so that they could have their, the way soybeans work is you send them, you can't eat soybeans. Even the animals can't unless they're processed. And they send them away and you'll get back the equal amount, but it won't necessarily be your soybeans. And here they were growing all of these healthy soybeans. They wanted their own. So we helped them think about how to get local soybean processing. And he says, we really like that because now we have a couple extra jobs in our community. It's great. And I'm like, okay, all this sounds good. So what's the bad news? I'm waiting for the bad news. He says, He says, but we were talking about you last night and we took a vote. Okay, he says. And, you know, he says, we probably, this was just after the 2016 elections. And he says, you know, we realized we probably didn't vote for the same people. And I said, yeah, that's mm-hmm. right. We probably didn't. But, you know, we have more important things to work on. He says, yeah, yeah, we know. That's why we like working with you. It's not about the politics. It's about the people and the soil. Okay, okay. He says, but, and this was when Trump was just coming in, he says, but, he says, we're very upset about the president-elect. We don't like any of his candidates for agriculture secretary. And I'm like, this is interesting news. He says, so we took a vote and we said, we're going to call Elisa. And if they're going to protest the agriculture secretary list, we wanted to know that we're there with you 100%. We'll mm-hmm. protest with you. I mean, so here were right. very conservative farmers who voted right. the other way that we did, got the election they wanted, but didn't like the secretary. So they're going to protest with us. I mean, you know, I mean, it's just like, and we've had, I could tell you so many stories like that, because when you work together on things that matter, and food is a big one, whether you're talking about your community or the farming community, people come together. And so it, one of the things when I think about things like climate, the word I like to think about is repair. How do we repair? Mm-hmm. And we need to repair at every level. So who owns the land? Who gets exposed to the emissions? You know, how do we repair the climate itself? But that's the power of these amazing solutions that we can each be part of. Is we can be part of the repair.
Yeah, as I listen to you, I think about, you know, this podcast is a project of Post Carbon Institute, and, you know, and we have this mm-hmm. online magazine, Resilience, that republishes, you know, publishes new articles. And that's very uplifting, you know, and people can, I'm not doing a plug for Green America, but, you know, people can, I sort of think what, as I listen to you, that one thing people can do that encourages the direction of rightness, the direction of repair, is to consume the news that comes out of organizations that are really working on the leading edge of the intersection of social, environmental, and political change, you know, so that you actually on a daily mm-hmm. basis can start to get ideas of what's happening. And I know, you know, it's very common now to rag on social media, you know, but it's, I just can see that, you know, getting 10 newsletters, just pick the 10 you like, that provide stories like you're telling of people making changes locally in their community, mm-hmm. personally in their household. Maybe, you know, like in my town, we had a group of people, young people, really, United Student Leaders that insisted our town have a climate crisis action committee. So, you know, and that is, you know, so the more you read and consume, the more you consume the stories like you're telling, the more your imagination is lit up about what you can do. And I think there is a passivity, the enormity of the problems that we're facing and how out of control it seems can lead to a passivity. And so in a way, it's not like buy an electric car. It's like just read about people who are buying electric cars or read about the people, mm-hmm. people making the energy transition. That can give you the courage to break out of the trance of mm-hmm. impossibility and passivity. You know, it's not even victimhood. It's just like, what can I do? So I'm excited about the role of your organization as a storyteller, my organization as a storyteller, and consuming that, you know, not ungrounded, grounded news of what's going on in the world where people are coming together, they're working hard, they get an idea, they implement. So I appreciate that. There, you do have a newsletter, right? I'm not asking you to do a pitch. But.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, we, like everybody else, we, you know, our job is to tell these stories and to encourage people to take action. So, you know, on our website, greenamerica.org, you can come and you can see all this for free, you know, and, you know, please tell the stories. You know, you might be interested, for example, in one person might be interested in the food part. Another person might be interested in the renewable energy part. Somebody else might be wondering, what can I do with my finances? You know, I just want everyone who's listening to know, I learned at Vicky's feet about how to take those, how to really, you know, talk about what's going right, you know, how to manage your own personal finances in a way that's supporting your own life and your own joy, and is also reducing the impact on the whole world. Because if we're mm-hmm. consuming less, we're making a huge difference. And I just, what you're saying is so true. It's like, you know, I know you've all heard this quote a million times, but it's so true. You know, Margaret Mead said, you know, if it's a small group of people that takes these first steps, and it's what changes the world, and it's what always has. And, you know, I'm remembering, as you were talking, Vicki, I was remembering something that we did in, I think, probably sixth or seventh grade science. And maybe, you know, you've done this where you make the crystals, the salt crystals.
Right.
And I had this really amazing science teacher, and you know, she always was trying to make it fun and to connect. And so one day she shows up and she's got this big beaker of water in front of the class, and she's got this string in the beaker. And she says, right. Well, today, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to make salt crystals. And we're going, what? How are you going to do that? You know? So anyway, she had us all line up, and we all kind of put pinches of salt. And she said, and I want you to pay close attention. And so we would file by, and we'd each put a little pinch, you know, and we went around the room and came back around. And she said, I want you to pay attention to that string, because at some point you're going to see salt crystals. And so, and like, okay, really? Sure enough, of course, it did happen. We started to see the salt. And so there was a little boy, and he was the first one to notice. His name was Emilio. And he said, oh, the salt crystals. And we broke out of line. We all rushed over there to look at the salt crystals. And sure enough, you know, and we were all like jumping up and down. And we said, oh, Emilio, you did it. Look, you got the salt crystals going. And so, you know, she got us all back to putting a little more salt in, and the crystals got bigger, and then she had us all sit down. And one of the things she said was, you know, you all jumped up and down, and you pounded Emilio's back and said, congratulations. She said, but you know what? He put the last drop of salt in until we got those crystals. Every one of you, mm-hmm. if you hadn't put your little drop of salt in, Emilio's drop of salt wouldn't have made those crystals. And that's really, you know, she said, it's so funny, because she says, today's class, our lesson is about solutions. And she meant salt
yeah,
solutions.
Right.
but it's really about all solutions, right? You know,
right.
It takes somebody getting started. It takes somebody contributing and, you know,
right.
Get started. Oh yeah. Look, if we put salt in the water, we could get salt crystals. It takes more and more people joining in.
Right.
And as you get the early results, then people get more excited for more results, because the minute we got the little crystals, we wanted big ones, and so we put more salt in, you know, and no one of us can do it alone. It takes all of us. So
right. It's
a story of solutions.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great wind-up story for this conversation. Yeah, it's very inspiring, you know, because I think that I myself have gotten a little overwhelmed by, you know, do my small actions in my household, in my community, you know, do they make a difference? Are they equal to the magnitude of what we're facing? And I think if only, Elisa, that people embody the spirit that you have, like I'm doing something, I don't know if it's going to work, but I'm engaged. That helps, because there's an anxiety and a sadness and a confusion and a disorientation in our times too. And so those sorts of things, you know, we have class, you know, kids that go and they raise a little salmon fry and they put them in the stream. You know, we have a lot of that stuff happening here where children are being encouraged to participate. Right. So is there anything final you want to add to the pot?
Well, that what you just said is so important. So we've been in some ways talking about the innovation side, the community side, the, if you will, the inspiration, and if you even want to say, so much as say, the spiritual side of creating the change in the system. You know, I could also put on my business blazer and talk about it from, but if you still wonder, you know, like, oh, but I'm only one person. Look, you know, our economy, 70% of our GDP is because of consumer choices. So right there, that tells you that what you do matters, right? You know, companies spend so much time on quote unquote consumer insights to figure out what people want, and you express it by what you purchase and what you choose not to purchase. And that does in fact have a huge impact on the system. They're very concerned about their reputation. So when organizations like ours go after a company to demand change, they realize that with social media, you know, everybody in the country could be talking about it pretty soon. So if you ever wonder, does individual matter, actions matter? I mean, for all the reasons we've been talking about in this conversation about the social and relational and inspirational side, yes, but it has real pragmatic, you know, so whether you're talking about companies or voting, all of those things, corporate leaders, government leaders, they pay attention to us and they lead after the leadership has been established by us.
Right.
So, and I think that's the story of the history of humanity. And so it really does matter. And sometimes people also worry, to your point also, about they're anxious about, well, what matters? What should I do? What you said was so important. I always say, don't get analysis paralysis, just get started.
Right.
You know, what you learn from getting started, you can change the course of action. You know, I mean, right now out in farm country, for example, there's a number of people that have different approaches to how to make your soil healthy. And it's like, they're all good. Pick
right.
the one that makes the most sense for you. Give it a try. And if you want to switch gears, not a problem. Don't worry about, don't try to analyze it to the nth degree, which program to start with. You know, choose a program and, you know, get started. And if you see another program later that you like better, switch. The important thing is to get started.
Get started.
So, you know, get started. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Elisa. I love listening to you. I've loved listening to you for 30 years. And I think the word indefatigable was invented for you.
Thank you, Vicki, and same right back to you. And I think everyone who listens to this podcast knows that, and that's why they tune in to hear you.
Hey, thanks for listening. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a 5-star review so that this hopeful message can get out to more people. Check out Post Carbon Institute's Resilience website for show notes and for more guest information. Thanks also to Asher Miller, Amy Buringrud, and Clara Winter of Post Carbon Institute, plus production assistant Michelle Wigg from frugalityandfreedom.com.